University of Princeton University. We'll link to his piece in The Nation, his latest book just out in paperback, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the New Cold War. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking at Mark Twain House and Museum at Hartford, Connecticut, Monday, July 21st at 7. And then on July 26th on Martha's Vineyard, that's Saturday, 7 p.m., Catherine Cornell Auditorium in Vineyard Haven. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Steve Martinez, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And now our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Live. Yes, we are. We're going live. We are live here from Henry Ford College. It's WHFR.FM, the station making waves from WHFR Dearborn. That's right. We're right here in Dearborn. And my name is Jay Kornick, station advisor here at WHFR-FM, and joined in the studio by our WHFR news director, John Conroy. Say hello, John.
Hello, people, and hello, Jay.
Can't hear you for some. Oh, I know why. Okay, we're very professional. That was actually a mic check. It's not just introduction.
There we go.
We can hear you now.
Now it's better. Hello, Jay.
Can you hear us now? No, you can hear me.
Yes. Yes. Hello, good folks out there.
Yes. Well, here we are. And what is this show? It is the new WHFR Journal. It's new because it's not the same as last week. It is our own individualized spin on the news and the issues that have to do with Dearborn and the surrounding communities. We do it once a week, every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., but also online. Yeah, we archive the show, and it's available for listening anytime after broadcast, WHFR.FM. Click on Talk Shows, click on WHFR Journal, and select your favorite date. And so you can listen to the show anytime. Tell your friends and neighbors. Yes, they want a little background. They want a little in-depth insight into what's happening locally. And remember, let's get it out of the way at the beginning. All opinions
expressed on this show are not necessarily those of anyone at HFC or WHFR. And we deeply appreciate freedoms of broadcast. Free will thinking is highly encouraged and welcomed audience feedback.
Yes. Any other people at WHFR? I mean, we're members,
yes.
So our opinions, yeah, let it
means
go.
Something.
Let it go, John.
Okay.
So here we are. Okay. Just do a quick survey. We got a lot of important stories, some more important than what the newspapers think, by the way, the weekly papers we took a look at this week and got some comments about what they say and how they say it. But last week, Sunday, Dearborn Press and Guide, that's July 13th, because today is July 18th, Friday, July 18th. Everett Institute is going to close. Did you hear about that, John?
I did hear about that
yes.
A little bit, yes.
Okay, well, it was on the national news. They reported it in regard to Corinthian Colleges Incorporated, which has had a bad time nationally, and various lawsuits have been brought against it and challenges about their operational procedures. They are a for-profit college, okay? And in many cases, they oversell their credentials and their success rate to their students, and their tuition is quite high usually, and even though they have ways for students to pay for it, the students wind up extremely deep in debt. Well, anyway, Corinthian has more than 70,000 students across the U.S. and Canada, making this the largest college by enrollment to undergo such a shutdown. And so it's not completely shut down, but it does have a few colleges, such as what's called Everest Institute, right here in Dearborn and Michigan Avenue. I think that's on the east side of town. Or is it the west side? 23,400. Anyway, So Everest is shutting down here in Michigan because it's part of the Corinthian College's incorporated group that's had a lot of problems. Again, the education department of the U.S. And other groups have been investigating whether the company submitted false job placement rates and student attendance records, among other things. So it's been somewhat of a scandal for years. I saw a documentary about certain other for-profit colleges, and the name will, the names don't escape me, but I'm just not going to mention them here, and similar types of problems in these, I call them almost diploma mills. There's a little technicality that a four-year institution doesn't have any sort of contact time requirement. So it means that, you know, unlike the K-12 and even Henry Ford Community College, we have to, by state law, have to have the students in class a certain number of hours, or classroom equivalent hours. If it's a lab time, that's figured out differently, but there's formulas for that. And so, but four-year school, no. Now, luckily, traditional four-year schools, they all follow a pretty much similar pattern to what community colleges do, but they're not required to. So there are some for-profit colleges that come in and say, oh, just go weekends for half year, you'll get you a four-year degree in business.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Well, are you really getting all that learning that quickly? First of all, I'd say it's impossible. Even if you read books fast, you can't write enough papers, you can't have enough discussions and back and forth with your professors, critical thinking can't really go on. And I call them diploma mills, even though they are legitimate in terms of the degrees that they're granting. Accredited one way or the other, but it does raise doubts. Now, this is not a criticism of mine of all for-profit colleges. There are some vocational trade schools that have a very specialized purpose, and usually, you know, they do a pretty good job. There's other for-profit schools other than Corinthian that also have graduates that are really happy they got that background and helped them get a job and so on. But Corinthian, Everest is going to be gone. Corinthian is way cut back, if not all of the campuses. Yeah, they're putting, they're putting 85 U.S.-based campuses up for sale, including the one in Dearborn, because they own the property, so they can get a little kickback from selling the buildings. All right.
Did you say, Jay, there were 70,000 students across the country?
Total, yeah. Wow. Right. So it means that out of, if you divide by 85, that's not too many, a couple thousand in each one, but still. If they're not doing a good job of education, if there's a sort of shady operating practices of one sort or another, they don't deserve to be out there. It's misleading students who have to pay a ton of money. It's not cheaper than traditional public schools, higher ed public schools. Okay. Just going to hit some other highlights before we get into opinion type things. Let's see. Yeah, from the Times-Herald this week, and I was in Press and Guide last week, a man is awaiting sentencing for burning the Koran, several Korans, here in Dearborn. Remember that story before Reverend Terry Jones was going to come in a couple weeks before there was Koran burning? Some people said, oh, it must be Jones supporters who are doing that to sort of inflame the local community and get the topics out there.
Right.
Well, as the... the Press and Guide indicates, he's the man who was awaiting sentencing after pleading guilty to burning Korans three times last month, twice outside the Karbala Islamic Education Center on Warren and once on Chase Road south of Tyerman. Okay. And we have a special guest coming in the studio. John has just left, but I will finish the story. My point here, it's interesting, is that the person who is awaiting sentencing is Ali al-Sada'i, and he's a Muslim himself. And why did he do this? He did this because he says that he had approached the imam at the Karbala Center and asked for help with finances. He had some financial trouble. He did not receive any help, he says, and therefore, in protest to not receiving help, he actually burned the Korans. And, of course, the Iman actually has said he didn't remember the man, even. So what's my point in bringing this up? Well, first of all, I like to debunk stereotypes on this show. There's too many people, when something happens, they all think that one thing or another must be the cause. Maybe because they listen too much to certain 24-hour television cable news channels, huh? And I mean both the liberal ones and the conservative ones. So this show, we try to go behind the scenes, and I just wanted to point out, a lot of people thought, oh, it must have been supporters of Terry Jones, local supporters that hate Islam in general, and they were trying to stir up the issue here right before Reverend Jones came into town. And it's not that. It's an Islamic person, a Muslim, who was upset with his own center, the Karbala Center, for not helping him, according to him. And he's the one that burned the Quran, which is his own holy book, but he is the one that did it. So you can't easily stereotype any of these questions. You have to wait for the details. So I'm not blaming this Muslim person for what he did, although I'm sure other Muslims would, because it's their holy book, of course. But I'm just pointing out that you can't always jump to a conclusion, or sometimes you can say jump to contusion, about what the cause of something is and who's responsible. It's just not fair to anyone. And in this case, it certainly wasn't anyone protesting the Muslim religion here in Dearborn. Okay? Well, we have a special guest in the studio going to go right to that interview now. And we're joined by the famous, if I may say, the famous director of plays in Dearborn, Mary Bremer Beer. Mary, thank you for coming to the Journal today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And thanks for those kind words.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine anyone who's lived in Dearborn for even a short period of time not know your, or at least seen your name associated with a lot of great local play productions. But with all due humility, which you don't need to have because I'm asking you to say that, give a little bit of your background and your history with dramatic productions in Dearborn. You know, I think my daughter was in one of your children's theaters productions years ago. We won't say how far back, but give us a. I was trying to guess in my head how many plays you've directed. I know you've been involved in many ways, but 4 dozen more?
Oh, I suppose over the years that I've been involved in theater, I've directed maybe 100 plays,
yeah,
or more.
Okay, that's about
not
right.
All in Dearborn. I worked for the University of Detroit Mercy for 30 years, and I'm happy to be here working as an adjunct professor at Henry Ford Community College. I have forgetting the humility here.
Absolutely.
I have a Detroit Free Press Career Achievement Award, and for numerous magazines and Detroit Free Press and news, I have a Best Actor and Best Directing Awards, and I've been very fortunate to work with a lot of good people, and there's a lot of talent in Michigan, and I'm an actress as well as a director, and but the city of Dearborn is very special because I was hired there in 1979 to run the children's program, and
right.
I'm still there. And I suppose more than 1,000 children have gone through that program, and sure. I see them all the time. They pop up everywhere, and it's wonderful, and I have a special feeling for the work we've done in Dearborn, and the city has been marvelous in supporting that program over the years.
Well,
I also ran a study abroad program for the University of Detroit, Detroit Mercy,
great, yeah.
Study abroad in Greece for 25 years.
That's so important to see other countries.
Oh, it is,
yes.
And to learn about
the language and to see other countries.
Yeah, and to learn about the other styles of acting.
Oh, yes, in theater,
and
too.
And so it's been a great fun. It's my life. I love it. And
if I'm not mistaken, the theater sort of started in Greece, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the birthplace of theater.
Yeah, of course, right. Sophocles, Aristophanes, and so on, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's still very strong. Here in this country, the national pastime is football. There, it's theater. And actually performing in those ancient Greek amphitheaters is a thrill beyond comparison.
Let's not forget wrestling too. That's theater today too. That's really theater, boy. That's,
absolutely.
That's tough work, especially the choreography of all the falls and the stunts that are not really as damaging as they appear to be, you know. But let's move on. You also have a little side credit here. Theater is in the Blood. Is it your son? Chris
yes.
Bremer is a director. Then he's been a director here at the college.
Yes, and he's also, this is a new promotion, executive director of the Jewish Ensemble Theater in West Bloomfield.
Oh, that's great.
This just happened. And he's a very fine director, and we both love working here at Henry Ford Community College. They're very good to us, very kind, and it's a good department, and it's run well. And it's a different kind of student from teaching at U of D. And these students that we have are very hungry. They're anxious to learn. And many of them are very green, and we don't have a lot of bad habits to break.
Well, there you go.
From community theater actors.
Well, I'm just another aside on the Jet Theater, the Jewish Ensemble Theater. I've gone to several of their productions, really high quality, and I'm sure that Chris will continue that and maybe overachieve with them too, because it's a wonderful organization. It's really worthy of everyone's support, not just people who happen to be Jewish or live up in West Bloomfield. But,
yes, and I'm directing the second show there this
this
fall. It opens in November, and it's called Interlaughing by
Carl
Reiner.
Yeah, that's a fantastic title. Well, the reason that she's here, folks, is because in just 3 weeks from yesterday, as they say, which always seems kind of backwards, but 20 days from today is the opening of a play here at Henry Ford Community College's Theater in the Adrey Auditorium of the Fine Arts Center, The Good Doctor. So, and you're the director. This is, again, Mary Bremer Beer here with us. And so tell us a little bit about the background of the play. Jerry Jablinski, who directed the last play here, came in and mentioned it, of course, that it's also by Neil Simon, who directed the last play. But it's really different than, it's comedy too, but it's a little different. Give a little background of The Good Doctor.
Well, you know, Neil Simon is one of America's most prolific playwrights. Mm-hmm. And he did mostly contemporary shows that took place in the 80s, 90s. He was a king of comedy at that time, and still, and through the his shows are still done today and will be for many years ago. These two are different, the one that Jerry did and the one that I'm doing, The Good Doctor, because they're based on, at least mine is based on, Chekhov's short stories. They're adapted from them. And I believe that his father, it may have been his mother, but I believe his family was from Russia. Mm-hmm. So he was calling on that background.
Right.
And they're wonderful, funny plays. There's a lot of irony, a lot of deeper truth in them, but they're very funny. And the humor ranges from dark humor to fall off the chair and roll in the aisle laughing.
So are there three or more?
Oh, there's more. There's
there's
10, I think. 10,
okay.
Yes.
Right.
And we have 14 cast members, two of which are faculty members. One is Judy Fletcher, who's the costumer, been around a long time.
Yep.
And she has a beautiful voice,
here.
And there's only one little musical number in it. And Judy is in it, along with David Alexander, who was a Shakespearean teacher, an English teacher at Fordson High School for many years. And it's a sweet little piece called Too Late for Happiness.
As you mentioned, Henry Ford College has the theater department gets a lot of beginning actors, maybe some with some experience in high school, not necessarily community theater, but sometimes. But it's also a mix of some older citizens from the community, seniors and middle-agers, who want a little life enrichment, and it's almost become an avocation for some of them, and they have significant experience because they've been in several plays already. But
this is very true. I have a friend who did a show for me many years ago, Carol Teagarden, who was a reporter for the Free Press for a number of years, who's coming into my Acting 2 class this this coming semester.
Yes, we should mention that Mary is also assisting our theater department in instruction, too.
Yes. So, yeah. And, you know, we just love it when we have the older people. Life, nothing better than life experience mm-hmm. to bring to your roles when you're doing it.
And there's less makeup required if they're cast as an older person, you know.
Absolutely.
You should walk with a little bit of a limp. I already have one. No problem.
I don't have to act.
Right. Or it can be part of their character all of a sudden, you know, a little added touch. Sure. And this will be great fun. Now, it's not for 3 weeks, folks. So just remember, this is going to be after Dearborn Homecoming. It's going to begin here at McKenzie Fine Arts Theater, Henry Ford College campus, August 7th, 8th, and 9th. So that's Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays at the usual 8 o'clock start time. And 2 p.m. on Sundays.
Yes, there's only one Sunday performance, and that's the 17th.
Yes. Right.
And that's at 2 o'clock, yes.
Yes. So, okay, so that's the second week. It's only Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So the Thursday is only in the first week.
Right.
And then there's no Sunday.
But
why did it work out that way? Was the theater taken by some other purpose on that first Sunday?
Well, there are rentals. I'm not sure if that date is a rental or not, but there are rentals that happen.
Well, I think Thursday is a great day to catch it. There's usually a couple fewer people that come on Thursday, so there's no problem with getting front row center, right?
Right.
Usually. But it's great. I attended the last play there. I haven't for a lot of years. I always felt that, well, I know how good our productions are, and I don't want to take up extra seats. But there's usually a couple extra seats, so why not go and enjoy it, you know? And again, we have a lot of highly qualified people behind the scenes working not only with Mary Bremer Beer's distinguished career behind her as a director here this time, but also doing set design. I assume Jerry Jablonski is doing tech theater.
Yes.
He's usually around for that.
Yes, we have George's Dinosaurs coming up in the fall.
Wow. Yeah.
And so there are a lot of things that are happening on that theater, technical things on that stage. So we've adapted the stage. So there's very little scenery in this.
If you look off to the side, are there some dinosaurs waiting in the wings? No, not yet.
They'll growl
big,
occasionally.
Big eggs ready to be hatched.
Yes.
That would be a great promotion. You have these eggs with a, you know, giant eggs with a little crack in it sitting around town, you know. wait for November, you know.
That's, in the lobby. Yes.
Yeah, wherever.
Or maybe big teeth on the curtain, you know.
Oh.
Mm-hmm, yeah. No, that's going to be, a virtual reality play, which means there's going to be live actors, but the special effects, the backgrounds are going to be provided by computer graphics, all designed and worked on, I think, the last 4 years at the theater department here. So it's not... a canned production that they bought or brought in from somewhere. It's all done locally, and tremendous multimedia skills are being developed by the students helping and,
Absolutely.
Of course, our tech people.
I don't know if you know this, but Henry Ford College is the only college in the state that has green screen equipment.
Mm-hmm.
The students are learning on state-of-the-art equipment and film.
Good to mention.
Film.
I knew that. But and one of the few in the country to do virtual reality theater, too. And been honored in Washington, D.C. at one festival or another for one of their previous virtual reality productions. So it's really special, folks. Dinosaur is coming up in November, and you can go online to hfcc.edu, the theater department, and you can even reserve tickets in advance because they really do, they're going to go fast for this production.
Oh, they certainly are. And they're bringing in school to see this production as well.
But they can online purchase tickets in advance if they want to for The Good Doctor. And that's, again, the theater website, if you just want to go directly there. It's not hard to remember. It's theater, and it's T-E-R, right?
I don't know.
Well, it says
R-E.
I thought it was R-E. No, I've got two things published here. I know George Popovich, head of our theater program, always felt it should be T-R-E. Some sort of classic
it's British,
theatrical.
It's English, yes.
Almost, well, théâtre in French, it's spelled that way. So the French word for theater is spelled T-R-E.
T-R-E, yes.
With that little mark over the E. But anyway, it looks like here it is theater. And theater dot the typical American spelling T-E-R dot hfcc.edu. So it's pretty easy to find, and you can do online ticket purchases in advance. It's just $12 general admission, hardly more than a movie, and so much more entertaining. A lot of people have never gone to live theater or except in high school, and this is definitely a few steps above most high school productions. No insult to high school productions, but we have really distinguished people involved at all levels, including acting. usually. And seniors, only $12 a person. Students with ID, you can show that at the door or something when you get here. You can still reserve your tickets in advance, only $8 a person for students. So this is The Good Doctor. Can you maybe just tell us the plot of one of those 10 vignettes, one of your little favorites there, without giving away the punchlines or the ending, maybe?
Well, there's a piece that opens Act Two called The Drowned Man, and it's about a sailor who makes extra money by impersonating a drowned man, and he charges 3 rubles for this. And the plot, the outcome is, and I'll tell you, is he can't swim. And so he depends on someone diving in to save him.
Very funny piece. In a previous life, I was an English professor here at Henry Ford College for many, many years, and I have read that short story. You just brought it back to me. It is a stitch. It is really, and it'd be great to see it acted out. I mean, that's especially adapted by Neil Simon, of course, who knows theater pretty well.
Sure. So. We also have The Sneeze, which is the opener for the show, and it's a about a general who attends the opera. And so a man who works under him loves opera, and he comes to the opera and has seats right behind the general and accidentally sneezes all over the general's head.
It kind of goes
downhill from there. Very funny piece. Yeah. Witty dialogue.
Well, I'm sure everybody is now looking forward to attending The Good Doctor. It is August 7th, 8th, and 9th. Check which days those are. 15th, 16th, and 17th also. If it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, it'll be at 8 p.m. If it's a Sunday only on the 17th, it's at 2 p.m. So after Dearborn Homecoming's over, after you vote in the primary election on August 5th, remember the play the very next weekend here and the next 2 weekends after the election. Something great to do in August. A lot of people say, oh, nothing to do in August. I guess I'll just lay out in the backyard. And, well, you can lay out in the backyard during the day. Come to the play at night or at 2 p.m. on Sunday.
Come to the show.
Yeah.
Yes,
so.
And I hope to see both of you.
It's
Jay
been
and John,
well.
Here.
I hope we can get there.
The last play that was there, Fools. We were both there.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
And the humor. I just wanted to say that the humor was fantastic, and if it's half as good as this humor, this play will be great.
Equally good, I'm sure.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. And so, Mary Bremer-Beer, thank you so much for coming by. Was this your first time at the station?
No, I did a show I directed last summer. I think I was here. I think it was either last summer or summer before.
You talked to me.
I think so.
Oh, how soon I forget. I went through a little health problem in the fall.
Maybe
and
not then, maybe
it's like
not
6 months, so I don't remember too much. But
don't worry.
But no, it's been an honor to meet you again, perhaps. And, and I know you were the director of some play that my daughter was in with the Dearborn City Rec Department. And so thank you very much. Thank you for the fantastic career and giving your time to both play directing and instruction here in the theater department at Henry Ford College.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me today.
Thanks so very much for coming by. We're going to listen to a report about recycling household batteries. Yeah, that's very important. I know you just missed the hazardous waste pickup here in Dearborn, but we have an ongoing facility in one of our buildings here that will collect them. So listen to this and take note. We'll be right back with more WHFR Journal.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the easy-to-use website building platform that includes customizable templates, drag-and-drop tools, 24/7 support, and e-commerce. Learn more at squarespace.com, promo code NPR.
What to do with all those batteries? This is the Environment Report. I'm Mark Brush, in for Rebecca Williams. I was surprised to find out recently that you can't recycle household batteries in my town anymore. Recycle Ann Arbor's website says, alkaline batteries do not contain hazardous materials and may be disposed of in the trash. Mercury is no longer used in common alkaline batteries, so they say trashing them is okay. But it seems like there ought to be a way to recycle them. Here at Michigan Radio, we use a lot of batteries.
I usually buy a box of 500 AA batteries probably every 2 months.
That's Bob Scunn, our chief engineer. Reporters and producers here go through around 3,000 AA batteries a year. That's about 150 pounds of batteries. We use them in our audio recorders and cameras. The University of Michigan, our employer, makes us recycle them.
They're still requiring that we put them in a bin and then they come pick them up. I'm not sure what they're doing with them afterwards.
Right. Well, I found out.
You found out. Yes. What are they doing, Mark?
They're taking them to this recycling facility in Brighton.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's right. And if you're tuning in, Bob, this is where our batteries get recycled. Neil Brown is the manager of this plant for RBS Metals in Brighton, Michigan. He says they process thousands of pounds of alkaline batteries from all over the country. We watch as batteries drop on a conveyor belt. The belt carries them into the machine.
So it gets hammered by 48 hammers inside the hammer mill. It gets pulverized and separates all the chemistry of the battery, and then it comes down into this vibrating sieve.
Brown says they recover all the materials from the batteries. Piles of fine black powder and little chunks of steel sit in large bins around the warehouse.
Nothing gets thrown away. It's all right here. That's all the powder. That's all the zinc and manganese that's in there. That's all the paper and plastic and brass that made up the battery, and that's all the steel of the battery.
Brown says fertilizer companies buy up about half of the zinc and manganese they collect. Another company is interested in the brass they pull out, and the steel, of course, is easy to melt down and use again. So if they can sell off all of these parts of the alkaline batteries, why aren't more people doing it?
If you're an individual processor, the amount of money that you spend collecting, processing, transporting does not offset the cost of the materials that you get at the end of the process.
Mark Bullish heads up the Corporation for Battery Recycling. He represents battery makers that are trying to develop a recycling system that makes financial sense. The University of Michigan pays around 50 cents a pound to recycle our alkaline batteries. Simply driving these batteries to a recycling facility is one of the biggest costs. And researchers at MIT say that also adds to the environmental costs. They found that depending on the program and how far the batteries have to travel, the amount of fuel burned to transport and process these batteries can offset any environmental benefits. Experts say the way to fix that is to develop the infrastructure to move these batteries more efficiently. Bullish says that's the kind of system they're trying to develop now.
We recognize that we have to start somewhere, and that's what we're doing. We're trying to model this so we can get to that, and we certainly recognize we may not be there day one.
A proven ground for an efficient battery recycling system might start in Vermont. That state passed a law that requires companies to come up with a system for household battery recycling. It'll go into effect in 2016. In the meantime, if you just don't feel right about tossing those batteries in the trash and your city doesn't recycle them, there are mail-in programs you can use. You can find us at michiganradio.org to learn more about that. And that's the Environment Report. I'm Mark Brush.
And we want to thank Michigan Public Radio for allowing us to rebroadcast that little environmental report that runs on other stations, not directly in this area. I think it's twice a week. But you can get it yourself anytime as a podcast from like iTunes store and even directly from their website. You can sign up in a way that your computer will automatically download it without going to the iTunes store to grab a podcast that way. So you don't have to just use iTunes. There's other ways of doing it. Oh, yeah, a lot of ways to do it. But just a point there is that there is real danger in just tossing your regular household batteries, the AA, the AAA, D, C, whatever, into the wastebasket. And even worse is batteries coming out of a computer, like a laptop or something, because they're much bigger. And they have toxic substances in them that you don't want to get in the landfill. There's enough there already that will come back, not just to haunt us, but to kill us in the future and our children, future generations. So we got to work now to always think about recycling appropriately, reduce, recycle, reuse. And you say, well, is those, you mentioned recycling, is those rechargeable batteries any better? No, there's a similar toxic problem with them, but they do cost less in the long run, because you're paying for the electricity that's used to top them off again, to reestablish them as batteries after they get down low. So, you know, you're just sort of changing where you're paying your money. But it is actually, I think, environmentally a little bit better if you use rechargeable batteries. But the disposal of them is still an issue. As I said, here at Henry Ford College. We did the big annual hazardous waste collection for the city of Dearborn a couple weeks ago. And you said, oh, I missed it. Well, you can just, you know, get a bucket for the basement or something, and or in your garage, and just throw your old batteries into that bucket and just wait for the next time there is a hazardous waste recycling event in your community. But here at Henry Ford College, we got a little bucket. It's not too big. It's not huge. But every couple weeks, I bring batteries from home and from friends in and toss them into the bucket. It's in the sort of security office right at the front of the campus on 5101 Evergreen Road. And if you just go in there and ask the security guards, where's your recycling battery bucket, they will show you where it is. It's not, doesn't have a big sign or anything or flashing lights on the roof, but it's in that first building right next to the visitor's lot, right next to the flagpole at 5101 Evergreen Road, if you want to come by and drop them off here. A lot of businesses do have them. I think especially some of the stationery stores. Besides collecting toner cartridges, I think some of them will collect batteries, laptop batteries too. I mean, ask at Staples and Office Max and places like that. But do not toss them in the regular trash. Same goes for, by the way, fluorescent light bulbs. You know, those little squirrely ones, the spiral ones, those have toxic things in them too. The LED lights, light bulbs, which are a little more expensive again, but last even a little bit longer, they don't have any toxic chemical in them. So that's the ultimate choice if you've got to have light bulbs, even though, oh my gosh, you might be paying $15, $20 a bulb, but you may never have to replace them in your lifetime. Plus, when they do get tossed somewhere, if they are accidentally tossed in normal trash, they won't be a problem damaging the environment, damaging future populations. Oh, I thought, word to the wise. All right. Moving on with some of the smaller news. Let's see. Well, it's all big news here, one way or the other. So just jump back in. Funding has been secured for two downriver greenways. Oh, good, you say. I love bicycling and hiking. Well, this is from last Sunday's Press and Guide. My problem with that, and I'm all for recreation and exercise. That's very important. First of all, how much money is coming in for these two projects in the Downriver region? Okay. The Greenways Initiative, what is it? It links, represents 21 communities striving to create a non-motorized trail system throughout the southern section of Southeast Michigan. To date, more than $12 million have been invested in more than 50 miles of continuous pathways. Where are these pathways? Linking four major metro parks. So if you can get to one metro park with your car and your bikes on them, you can then bike to another metro park where you don't have a car. See my problem with this? But you need a car to get to the metro park, unless you live right next door to it. Well, my problem with all these projects is not the cost. It's actually very inexpensive if you compare it to other things. But we need bicycle pass for transportation to get from your home to your grocery store, from home to your bank, from home to your place of work, places you go every day. Because gasoline is going to become more and more scarce. It's going to become more and more expensive, and that's happening now, and it's going to get a lot more expensive pretty quick over the next few years, next 10 years or so. In about 20 years, almost no average person or no poor person will have enough money to even pay for gasoline, much less for a car. And so we need alternate transportation. Bus system? Well, that's got a long way to go here in Detroit. We got to rebuild one almost from the ground up. There's a ballot proposal coming up on the August 5th, during the August 5th election, asking whether or not you want to fund the smart buses. Well, do you? Do you, huh? If you don't, there's no bus transportation that really gets to where you are and takes you where you want to go. Because the system based in Detroit doesn't extend far enough, doesn't have enough hours, doesn't have enough bus runs. It's not frequent enough, in other words. And, of course, other cities have bus systems that are far superior. You can get almost everywhere. Doesn't cost much. It's subsidized by taxes, but it benefits everybody. So a lot of people don't even have to buy a car. No car insurance, no gasoline. Oh, much cheaper to pay the extra money in taxes collectively through the whole community than and have a great bus system than to have all these cars that pollute and are dirty and wasteful. Economically, it's not a good deal. I mean, for the rich, it's a toy. It's a plaything. Leisure time fun. Status. Yeah, but for most people, no. So that's my only carp about this. It's wonderful. Unfortunately, the story is buried in A16, so I guess it's not very important. But the funding for these projects, the first project is getting $900,000 and was secured from Wayne County through a park millage. So it was money that was given to parks by you, but is going to go for these interconnecting trails instead. And also the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund. So that's all well and good, okay? And look for the completion. Construction is going to start on both of these links between Metro Parks this fall. And it'll be adding extra fun, a little extra challenge. Oh, let's bike all the way to another Metro Park. And then, of course, we had to turn around and come back because we left our car. Yeah, that we carried the bikes in at the park. But, you know, it'll be fun. It'll be interesting for recreation. But we need bicycles for transportation. I said this 10,000 times on this show. Tell your friends. It is the answer to a lot of our problems is to get healthy. But we can't do it without a little government help to get the bike paths in place and the signage and the education to train the drivers to share the road, which they're not very good at doing right now. A lot of people in a hurry to get nowhere, I think, as fast as possible in cars that are far too polluting. Okay, well, that's the story. I'm all in favor of the Downriver Greenways. Don't get me wrong here, but we need bicycle transportation funds, and it won't cost much. I doubt it's even going to cost $12 million. My God, $12 million already? And they're still not done? Wow, that's a lot. So, John Conroy has rejoined us after escorting our guest out of the building. And, John, what do you have for stories? Hit me with one.
Okay. I would like to talk a little bit about Roar on the River down in Trenton this weekend. It is a hydroplane boat race, and there's different classes of boats running. And it'll be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Lots of food vendors as well and entertainment with 50-amp fuse and a few other bands from the local area playing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Big event. Lots of free parking all around the town.
And the exact location?
It is...
This is on the Detroit River down by Trenton.
3300 West Jefferson Avenue, and you can't miss it. Like you say, it's right on the river by Elizabeth Park.
Okay. So drive down towards Trenton on East Jefferson, and right before you get to Elizabeth Park, perhaps, is where the biggest viewing areas would be. But
sure, and there'll be shuttle buses coming from the Kennedy Center, the Recreation Center up on West Road. There's lots of signage to tell you where to park, and it should be a great time. Mm-hmm. Weather's
that starts today?
Good. Starts today.
Yeah, okay. So if you hear loud roaring noises from the Detroit River down that way. I wonder why they chose, I mean, it's a great idea, but usually aren't the hydroplane races up closer to Detroit?
Well, I believe there's a second round.
There's more.
Detroit
I read river. Somewhere that one of the hydroplane drivers in the Detroit River a couple of weeks ago actually had a bad accident.
I
think they were testing. I don't think it was an actual race.
Right. Yeah, they were knocked out of the race. Yep.
Or maybe there was a race.
There was.
Okay. Yep. So we got a lot of hydroplane races here. Detroit's sort of known for that.
lots of hydroplane races, and then even more importantly in the morning to get your energy taken care of, there's a pancake breakfast put on by the scouts on both Saturday and Sunday.
Oh, my goodness. You can stock up on pancakes there.
And there you go.
Yeah, nothing better to have you sit and watch hydroplane races for a few hours than to have your stomach full of pancakes to start with.
Yeah.
That's fun. So it's called Roar on the River?
Roar on the River.
Okay. Yep. Trenton, this weekend, check your local listings, or I bet there's a website or City of Trenton must have connection. Is there more information via
www.trentonroarontheriver.com.
Okay, that's obvious. Okay,
it's also on Roar on the River Facebook page.
Okay, well, that's everybody's got that, right?
Mm, yep.
What else you know?
Well, I also wanted to point out that, and it was published in the Wednesday, July 16th. The League of Women Voters has candidate lists as at their website. Mm-hmm. And also, well, an online election guide, mm-hmm. and that is at www.vote411.org.
Right. That's easier to remember. I mean, League of Women Voters, LMW. Anyway, it's hard to remember, but League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights, .org is their website, but it's a lot easier to remember vote 411.org.
I think so, too.
And that'll get you more information about the upcoming candidates running for different races. There may even be, I haven't been there yet, but they usually have questionnaire, like three questions answered by the candidates on that website. So it gives you a little background, not much, as a teacher here at Henry Ford College. I know that if they answered their questionnaire and they spelled a lot of words wrong, I usually don't respect them much in the morning. But it could be all kinds of reasons, but I just, anyway.
Well, there's also ballot proposals listed on that website as well.
Yeah, yeah. There, again, last week, go to our website and listen to the show if you missed it. I spent a good amount of time and comments from Jack Lessenberry and Gary Warrenchuk about the three tax proposals that are going to be on the ballot, three funding proposals needing a funding consideration, and it's very, very important that you understand them. Last week, I made a lot about the fact that the first one that has to do with the personal property tax is completely misnamed, okay, but that was done by our legislature. It is not taxes paid on property owned by persons, but it's called the personal property tax. It's for taxes on business property, things in their buildings, not their property, not their land, not the building, but the stuff in the buildings. Okay, the machines, the computers, the, I don't know, furniture, and the value of that. They actually have been paying separate assessments, separate taxes for years here in Michigan. And the wisdom of the state legislature was to eliminate that particular tax, which is, again, mistakenly called personal property tax. So I'm sure everybody who's in business would love to have the repeal of that. But, of course, this money just was sort of turned around almost immediately, almost totally, by the legislature, by the state government of Michigan, going back to the local cities where it came from. And yet, if it's gone, how do the cities survive? This is important money. They'll all be bankrupt if they don't get the reestablishment of the money. So this was a plan, a compromise, maybe good or bad. Legislature worked out that some money coming from what's called use taxes in Michigan, collected now, but that money, at least in the near future, on into the near future, would go to reimburse the cities for what they're going to lose from not getting the personal property tax money sent back to them. So it's a compromise. It should work. A lot of cities are saying, yeah, but what about 5 years from now? Yeah, the legislature can play games, unfortunately, and hurt the cities by not continuing that financial support. Maybe it can come some other way in the future. But nonetheless, for the short term, it is a good compromise. I do not know any city council or any mayor in the local area that is against your vote of yes for that proposal. Again, it's no new money coming off your nose. And businesses, they want to stop having to pay that extra tax, of course. And maybe it'll reduce the cost of their products. I doubt it. So they can put more money into the salaries of their employees. I doubt it. It's a little satire here, folks. Just had to indicate that if you don't catch the tonal change of yours truly. So all business people who now have to pay it are definitely in favor of this compromise. And most of the cities sort of believe that they will get about the same money they have been getting from that source because of this compromise. So you decide, but I'm just saying there's a lot of support for that, and it is nothing to do with you having to pay more taxes. However, let's today jump to more details than I gave last week on the education enhancement millage. That's number three on the ballot. It's on the back of the ballot. And by the way, when you go to vote, at least here in Dearborn, it's not on a machine. They give you a paper ballot, and you've got to, you know, darken in the ovals and give it back, and then the machine counts it. But if you don't turn the ballot over, you won't vote for all the candidates in the primary that are there, and you won't vote in the education enhancement millage. Okay. Now, education enhancement millage. Supposedly, it goes to Wayne County. Okay. It is a 2 mil, 6 year education enhancement. So it's extra money, new money. Is that clear? Yeah. And why do the districts, and this is, I'm reading this directly, which is not my opinion. I'm reading this because Wayne RESA, that is the Wayne Regional Education Service Agency, used to be called Intermittent School District, I thought, but now it's Wayne RESA. Well, it is the Intermittent School District for Wayne County, and by state law is the organization that must place the millage proposal on the ballot. But this publication has the stamp of the Dearborn Public Schools because they wanted to let you know how they will benefit if this is passed for the county. So you say, well, to go to the county, we'll never see it, and it won't mean anything to Dearborn. It does mean something to every local community because it will be money pretty much divvied up and turned around to the communities that the money came from. Okay? So let me go through the frequently asked questions here. That this is a huge card. It must be, what do you think, 10 by 14.
10 by 14.
Yeah, that came to my mailbox, my home in East Dearborn, I think this last Wednesday, this week anyway, in the mail. And of course, if you read, and Jack Lessenberry's comment on this too, if you read the proposal that's on the ballot, you won't understand anything. In fact, all three of them. If you try to make sense, as a college graduate, if you try to make sense of the paragraph or two that are on the ballot, you won't be able to figure it out. But maybe it's worthy, nonetheless. I mean, who came up with that language? The state legislature. Just to know who to blame, okay? I mean, they're the ones that could push or shove the ballot language. I mean, you say, well, some ballots come from other sources, you know, by petition. These came from our legislature, okay? So they're responsible for the language and to make it incomprehensible. So, number one, why are you being asked? Well, it's going to help education in your local community. 2 mils, I think it's that in Dearborn, it's about $120 a year more for 6 years for the average home. Why do the school districts in Wayne County need the money? Because the per pupil foundation grant allocated to each district has been greatly reduced over the past several years for every district. That's right. Despite what Governor Snyder says and your friendly Republican legislator says, yes, they upped the money last year a little bit to a little bit higher amount to support the schools this year. Most of it didn't go into the classroom, though. Okay? It went because they had to legally give more money to the pension funds to fund them, according to law, laws that were passed. So what they did was not, oh, thank you, legislature, for that special gift. They had to do it. They had to make up for what they weren't doing before. And there's really no new money going into the classrooms. And all the local superintendents and school districts have said that. Don't believe what the legislature and the governor says. It's just not true. I mean, technically, yeah, they gave a little more money, but they had to, and it didn't go into classroom instruction. So if you want your schools to not suffer anymore, and they've been suffering for the last 3 years, then this is one way to help them. It's not sneaky. It is a legal way to do it. Despite substantial reductions in expenses, school districts are still struggling to balance budgets without cutting programs which are designed to produce college or career-ready graduates. So, how will they use the money specifically? Well, you could guess at this, but I'll just read it. Reducing class size. And, in fact, I just heard in Detroit that the emergency manager there, who is the big boss, the emergency manager, not Kevin Orr of the city, but the emergency manager, I forget his name, Roberts, is it, for Detroit Public Schools, he's going to increase the class size this fall. How many average students in each class? Up from 38 this year to 43.
Wow.
Believe me, as a teacher, I couldn't teach 38, much less 43. I know my daughter in Southfield Public School, she's got about 33, I think, in a class, and it's almost unmanageable for her. I don't know how she survives, how the students get anything out of it with that kind of class size. It's less in Dearborn, I know. I think it's 28 to 30 in Dearborn, average class size. 43?
That's crazy.
And, of course, why is it that high in Detroit? Because the emergency manager of Detroit Public Schools says so. Well, I got to make compromise. There's only so much money. Yeah, well, whose fault is that? It's not just the taxpayers in Detroit. It's the fault of the legislature, too. Your friendly state government. Okay? But will they do anything to resolve that problem in Detroit? No. It's their emergency manager that's making that really terrible educational decision. So this money goes to helping to reduce class size in all these districts that don't have emergency financial managers, increased instructional time for, you know, more time in class, slightly longer days for the teachers and the students so they can get more learning. Technology upgrades, always important these days. Facility repairs and upgrades, too. Can't have the roof leaking over them. My daughter's school, no air conditioning. So for 4 months a year, the last 2 months before dismissal in June and the first 2 months in the fall, in her classroom, which is facing the south side, southwest, she's on the southwest side of the building, she get all the sun, and the windows aren't insulated. So the average temperature is 110 degrees. She's got a thermometer, and it hasn't burst yet. But so she brings every fan she's got. Of course, they make noise, so she can hardly yell over the noise of the fans. And it's still hot air that's being pushed around. It's not cool air. I mean, it's hot air. And so, you know, schools, I think, they shouldn't have all that time off. I'm sorry. We need year-round schools. A lot of countries have them. I mean, with nice vacations here and there, you know, 3 weeks here or there between semesters so that the families can get together and so on. You need year-round teaching, but you got to air condition the schools. Oh, my God. They weren't built with air conditioning in mind. Can you believe that? 50 years ago? Just open the windows. You know, how many windows can open in modern buildings? Why? Because almost every building today is built with air conditioning in mind. Expensive to run, I know. No solar panels on the roof. No wind turbines around yet. So that's how districts will use the money when they get it back. And for Dearborn, it means, now get this, on an annual basis, if this passes, your little measly $2 million, I think measly if you have a job, I think it's very small to pay to improve education. This is the only option we have, folks. The legislature is not listening. Dearborn Public Schools will receive over $7.4 million each year for these 6 years. Well, that is really important. I think that's 7% increase in their budget, which is really makes a difference when you've got this many students, in any district. So that's the enhancement millage. It's number three. It's on the back of your ballot. Make a decision yourself, okay? See what you think is important for the future generation. Your kids, maybe, but even if you don't have kids, what about the kids in school now? What about the next generation, even if they're not yours? Do you think they deserve an education as good as what you might have had or better? Well, make a decision. And there's those two other proposals, but I think I've given you a little extra insight into the third one. All right, we have only a couple minutes before Highway 61. The Best in Blues with Joanne Kay is going to get started today at 2 o'clock till 6 p.m. So let's see what other stories we have. Well, Dearborn Homecoming is coming up, and I'm real excited. 2 weeks from today. And we at WHFR are all excited. Why? Because we're going to be part of it again. for the homecoming's been going on 30 plus years, I think, and we've been part of it since 1988. Wow. Every year we've been out there with our tent, with our booth, spreading the word, the gospel of WHFR, which has nothing to do with the show or my opinions, but it has to do with giving space for local news, local music, and alternative points of view, things you can't get from the major media in Detroit. So we're going to be there. We'll have our tent in the usual place, just opposite the carnival. If you just go north on Monroe Street sidewalk until it peters out, disappears into Ford Field, there we are. Our tent's going to be there. Look for us. Stop by. Say hello. We're going to have not only just our used CD sale, but we have been collecting donations of LPs, vinyl. Some of these things are collector's items. I mean, and you can still get turntables, luckily. Still, there's ways to connect them to your sound system. A lot of unique music on vinyl. In fact, I understand two-thirds of the music that was released on vinyl, that came out in vinyl from the turn of the century to now, is gone, is not on CDs, is not available any other way. But if you can buy the vinyl, you can hear it.
You can hear it.
Yeah. So we're selling those for we're not raising prices or doing a dollar an LP. That's long playing, 12-inch, 40 to 60 minutes of music, 12 songs usually. So we're going to have a big LP sale. Yes, we do a record show every October, and there'll be professional vendors with a wide range of, but we have ours too. And we need to raise money to keep our station going. And your little contribution, buying some stuff from us at Homecoming, will really help. Homecoming is a great event. There's a lot of free stuff for families. Let's see. In fact, that's several stories are now appearing in the Press and Guide and the Times Herald. Let's see. Last Sunday, okay, just briefly here, just as we're coming to a close, I think I can toss this in on page A17, almost buried at the end. Okay. And it's not there. How do you like that? Story on parking. I'm looking at the right page, I swear. I hate that when that happens. Maybe it's on the inside. Turn in the page here, folks. There it is. Okay. Okay. Free and affordable family activities. Going to run them down real quick. It's WHFR Dearborn you're listening to. WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Okay. This is the tradition. I said 30 plus. It's 35 years at Dearborn Homecoming. And it is an event coordinated by the City of Dearborn and the nonprofit Dearborn Community Fund. And the year's presenting sponsor, number one, numero uno sponsor, giving the most money, is Oakwood Healthcare. So thank you very much. I think it's now Beaumont Healthcare, but close enough. Okay. When they signed the contract, they were still Oakwood Healthcare.
Right. Yep.
Earlier in the year. So they'll have a big sign-up.
Together.
And, of course, it's at Dearborn's Ford Field Park, north of Michigan Avenue off Monroe Street in West Dearborn, as we call it. Of course, there's going to be carnival rides. If you get to your cityofdearborn.org website quickly, July 31st is the deadline. It's the day before the festival starts. Then you can get your tickets online. You can pay for them at a discounted rate for the carnival. There's no tickets to come and enjoy the music and the fireworks at the 3 days of Dearborn Homecoming. Let's see. That's the wristbands. Free giant inflatable rides for kids for bouncing on noon to 8 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. Free children's games from noon to 5